Hear ye, the Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We have with us, theoretically, we'll see if they're here, four Atkinson High School students. Are they here? Good. Would you please stand so we can recognize you? Thank you for coming this morning. You may be seated. And we have Maquonago Baptist Academy. Are these students here? Good. Please rise. Thank you all for coming. You may be seated. These students are here with us today with the Court with Class program that the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin sponsor. This is a national award-winning program. Students from all over the state are invited to join us for an oral argument. And if the invitation is accepted, the students are sent briefs of the case and discuss the case in class. So they are prepared, counsel. And as part of the Court with Class program, a justice meets with the students after the second case this morning. And we discuss the processes that the court uses, but not the substance of the cases we have heard. And we invite everybody in the courtroom to come to that session at noon. You need not be a student in either the Fort Atkinson or Maquonago Baptist schools. Having met all of you, I'm going to introduce the court. On our far left is Justice Patience, my far left. Patience Rogensack. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. To my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice, and I will do the noon presentation today. On my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox, and on his right, Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far right, Justice Diane Sykes. I want to say at each of the oral arguments today that I want to introduce Deputy Marshal Jack Bagley, who's outside talking and not listening to me.
bring Jack in.
He's doing his job.
He's still out there.
Good morning. I'm explaining to the group that you have been the deputy marshal for 18 years. You've done a marvelous job, and this job includes many tasks, but also getting all the briefs in order and delivered to the justices and returning records to the trial court and delivering or getting records and briefs distributed in appropriate places around the state. 18 years seems like a long time, but for us, Jack, it's not long enough. Mm-hmm. And on behalf of the entire court, I want to thank you for job well done, and we wish you the best in your retirement, you and your wife, and we hope you enjoy every single moment and that the moments be long. With those introductory remarks made, I will call the first case for today, 02-0528, Daniel Lynch et al. Versus Carriage Ridge, LLC et al. Arguing on behalf of the Lynches is Gary A. Ahrens, 25 minutes. We will then have Brian Butler arguing on behalf of Bunbury and Restaino. And then we'll have 5 minutes of Mr. Aaron's in rebuttal, and 5 minutes of Brian Butler in rebuttal, because we have an appeal and a cross appeal here. With that said, Mr. Aaron's.
Chief Justices, good morning. I'm Gary Aaron's, and I'm here to speak for the Lynches. As set forth by this court, the issues are, what is the range of equitable remedies available, and what purposes must they serve after there has been a finding of oppression by the managing partners in a limited liability corporation, LLC, created under Chapter 183? And second, did the circuit court err when it determined that the managing members of the LLC oppressed the minority members by issuing a capital call? The trial court properly found oppression. Accordingly, I am here to ask this court to order the majority of the limited liability company, Bunbury and Restaino, to buy out the Lynch's 25% interest in the LLC. This is a remedy which virtually every court faced with circumstances like these has found proper and necessary. The buyout remedy would accomplish three goals. First, it would prevent the Lynch's from being deprived of the value of their interest in Carriage Ridge LLC. Second, it would protect the reputation of Wisconsin as a safe place for capital investment by deterring oppression of minority shareholders and investors. And finally, it would reaffirm the broad constitutional power of Wisconsin circuit courts in equity. The trial court's remedy achieves none of these goals. The buyout remedy requested by the Lynches would achieve them all and would not even inconvenience Bunbury and Restaino. First, I ask this court to stop this plan to deprive the Lynches of the value of their interest. A single admission in the trial record by Thomas Bunbury answers both issues today in favor of the Lynches. Bunbury told the Lynches' veterinarian that Dan Lynch would not receive a cent from Carriage Ridge. It's in the appendix, A177, lines 8 through 9, 12 through 13. This statement establishes both oppression and why the trial court's remedies are inadequate.
How much had he received from Carriage Ridge, your client, up until this point?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first.
How much money? So if he hadn't received a cent, as I read this, how much money up to this point had your client received from Carriage Ridge?
About $43,000 on sales of over $4 million at that point.
And had he received a salary?
No.
Okay, so the negotiation, as I understand it, was over, where things broke down, was over this salary of, according to the briefs, as I understood, there was a amount that your clients wanted, and then there was a further amount offered. Is that?
I think that's correct, but I would add to it.
Okay.
I think that reflected at the end of a period where the relationship with the parties had eroded to the point where the original vision of this development, which was 40 acres of lots and 120 acres of horse facility, which had been changed by the management, became the equestrian part. Dan and Judy's part became smaller and smaller and smaller. They were just gradually eroded out. So I think that was the end of that. And I think that was the final sort of grinding down of the Lynches to where it was down to, you're going to work for us as employees.
Mr. Aaron's, what is the standard of review that we're supposed to give to the selection of a remedy by the trial court? In other words, are we supposed to give deference to that selection?
First of all, I believe the court owes deference to the trial court's findings of fact. I believe that the court here, however, then reviews the remedy as to determine whether it's an erroneous exercise of discretion. And in that sense, this court's review, I would ask this court to look at the entire set of facts, to look at those parts of the trial record where I believe, and we've set forth, that the trial court committed clear errors of law. And I think those errors of law prevented the court from apprehending the generalized nature of the oppression. In other words, the oppression here was a history of the lynchers getting nothing. And it was a slow pressure. It was a slow, patient process. The ultimate goal was that the lynchers receive nothing for their interest. And this is what the Oregon Supreme Court in Baker versus Commercial Bodybuilders held was, in fact, a definition of oppression.
As long as we're on that, what did the respondents get? So if the lynchers got, as I read this, it was $46,000, $43,000. What did the respondents get?
Well, so far what the respondents have gotten is they have sweetheart deals with management fees, with listing fees.
Well, now these sweetheart deals, these were, as I understand it, this started, this has been going on, let's see, in 93, so this is 11 years. And you mean sweetheart deals were signed under the agreement?
No, they were not. They were after the agreement. The management fee agreement is clearly contrary to the express language of the operating agreement. The commissions, the real estate commissions, the managers could never come up with a listing of prices. And finally, the horse barn, they're leasing a $750,000 facility. Well, for the rent they're paying, if this was a triple net lease at a shopping center, you'd pay, the tenant would pay rent plus taxes, maintenance, and insurance. And based on the rent they're paying, the value of the property is only worth $60,000, even though it was paid $750,000. And the simple matter is that no one else was allowed to bid for the opportunities to do this. There's an argument by the respondents that Mr. Bunbury's fees were modest. Well, the simple fact is that they're not modest. They're outrageously expensive because unlike Dick Henzel, who they set up as the counterexample, they didn't produce any profits. Richard Henzel said he would plan, in his next project, 2 years to sell the lots, and he planned a profit of $2.5 million. That's cheap. I'd be happy to pay him a higher fee because he's going to produce profits. No profits were produced here.
Counsel, you indicated that the first question before the court is, what is the range of equitable remedies available? How do you square that question with the words of the statute that is before us, 183.0902, which answers the question as to remedy, arguably in a single fashion, that is, a court may order dissolution?
I answer it by reaffirming the great breadth of the equitable power of the circuit courts of Wisconsin as constitutional courts. This court has held repeatedly in 1904 in Harrigan v. Gilchrist, in 1981 in Re Eberhardy, and most recently in GMAC Mortgage v. Gisvolt, that power is not to be circumscribed unless there is an express statement to that effect by the legislature. We are not permitted to discern innuendo or discern implication in a statute in a way that erodes that power which this court has and holds in trust as a constitutional court.
I'm mindful of the role that the courts play and the authority and power that we have. Arguably, under this statute, the legislature has specifically addressed the issue. It says, the circuit court for the county where the limited liabilities principal office is located may order dissolution of a limited liability company if any of the following is established. And, of course, one of those includes oppressive actions. But other than invoking our broad constitutional authority to fashion equitable remedies, do you have any other response to what arguably is the plain meaning or plain language of the statute?
I would respectfully dissent.
Okay, I've done that too.
Okay, so. I would say that had the court plainly meant that it was the exclusive remedy, that it was one, it was all or nothing, it would have said may only, or shall, or this is the exclusive remedy. And that is exactly what I meant by the reference to Harrigan versus Gilchrist.
What page?
Eberhardy.
In Harrigan.
Excuse me?
What page in Harrigan?
265.
It's a good number. Okay.
Let me be sure that I'm right.
All right, I'll check it, because as you know, that opinion runs
on 265
pages. Okay.
Harrigan.
Yeah, but you say, well, if the legislature wanted it only, they would have said only. Well, if the legislature wanted, you may craft a remedy that is equitable under the circumstances, or craft a remedy that as the circumstances permit, they would have written that too. So they didn't write either one of them. Is there anything in the legislative history?
May I respond?
Yes.
That would be a position that I could agree with if this court, the circuit courts of Wisconsin, did not already possess the power to craft an appropriate remedy. And that is what Harrigan versus Gilchrist emphasizes on page 227. And the language was repeated by this court in Eberhardy, and it is some of the most extraordinary language, I think, in this court's jurisprudence. We take a view to the very horizon of our mental perception within the scope of human capacity to violate obligations other than those of a purely moral nature, and the jurisdiction of our circuit courts, except as specially restricted by statute, specially restricted. Later on in Giswold, it was determined a clear command.
Eberhardy was the sterilization case. Is that right?
I'm blanking on that, Your Honor. I don't remember exactly. But it was about, Eberhardy cited this language. The language further down on page 227 is one of the most important maxims of equity there is. Equity will not suffer a wrong to go without a remedy. Now, for this court to say that this language restricts the court's powers in equity would align it with a single jurisdiction, Virginia, and against every other jurisdiction that has addressed this question, most recently the state of Washington.
They all have the same language as Wisconsin. Statutory
I cannot
language.
Assure you that it's exactly the same, but the Uniform Corporations Act was the act construed in Washington. And there has been a repeated argument that it's dissolution or nothing, and only Virginia has said that, and that decision has been ignored or criticized by each other court that's addressed it. And as a practical matter, what the courts have said is that this makes no sense. If there is the power to do the drastic equitable remedy of dissolution, then there ought to be the power to do something lesser. And this court did exactly that in the can't remember the name, in the Fromm Laboratories case in 1956, where there was, instead of a dissolution, the court said, let's see if we can work out a buy-sell agreement so as to maintain this company as an ongoing entity. It's Strong versus Fromm Laboratories. So there is precedent in this court emphasizing that it's not dissolution or nothing.
Isn't this a statutory claim, though? Or have you asserted a statutory claim or a common law claim? Or both? And if it's a statutory claim only, aren't we limited to the remedies specified in the statute?
Well, but the remedy specified in the statute is not limited in the statute.
Well, that's a separate question. Okay, To answer the first question,
a limited liability company is a creature of statute. So is a corporation. This is the argument that was made in Harrigan versus Gilchrist, in which in 1904, when the party that lost held that there's a new remedy, that's the exclusive remedy. And the court said, no, that's not the way it works. This declares the law. It adds to and reinforces the court's powers in equity. And the fundamental equitable basis for power here is the reach of the courts of equity over fiduciaries and fiduciary duties. So whether or not We can't have a fiduciary relationship created in the context of a limited liability company, which is a new, technically a new entity, and have that somehow free of the reach of equity and the power and the restraint of equity to restrain fiduciaries and to command them to their faithfulness.
Let me ask this question differently. If this claim did not exist in the statutes, would there be a claim at common law?
I believe that there would be a claim at common law. I think that's what the Court of Appeals held in Jorgensen, is that there was a claim, and in Jorgensen, the Court of Appeals, in line with the rest of the cases that I've cited today, held that the mere fact that a statute is passed does not, unless it's clearly stated that it's intended to do so, displace any earlier common law remedies. And here is the power of equity over fiduciary relationships.
Now, what's the difference between a majority buyout and a dissolution? You ask that the majority buy out the Lynches. Is there a difference with dissolution?
Well, in a practical way, as this Court's aware, shareholder agreements often include buyout provisions. They often include buyout provisions that relate to one party picking the price and the other party picking whether they'll buy or sell. In a dissolution, I would assume that if a dissolution was ordered, it would be ordered in the context of FROM. In a dissolution, the company is to be put on the market first. Anybody can bid. In a buyout, and a buyout here is one of the remedies that courts recognize because it minimizes the disruption that a dissolution would create, although practically, in some ways, it ends up at the same end. But here, the particular facts of this case move us towards a buyout because, first of all, it's not a problem for the manager's majority. Each has a net worth of $3 million. Each has an annual income of $500,000. They never suggested it would even inconvenience them. They never suggested there would be the slightest inconvenience. The only thing they lose is the chance to oppress the Lynches in the future.
Does the contract have a buyout formula?
No. No.
So you'd need appraisers.
Well, but the problem with that, Your Honor, is that the books and records of the LLC have been so badly kept that even Mr. Bunbury couldn't read them at trial. He couldn't understand them. We took the position that perhaps the closest way to get to this is to take his statements that he made to federally insured institutions under penalty of perjury as to the value of interest. That's how we came up with a number of $250,000 for the Lynch's interest, because there were statements to the State Bank of Cross Plains under penalty of perjury that of the value of Mr. Bunbury's interest of 37.5%. Then that went into the record. But there had been attempts at valuation, but because of the total disarray of the records, there are no financial statements, there are no audits. And as I said, even Mr. Bunbury couldn't read the records. It's extraordinarily difficult.
You want this court to, I'm looking at page 42 of your brief. Here. You want this court to order the majority to interests to buy the Lynch's interest at $666,666.66 plus a sum equal to 25% of the total excess interest, any amounts for legal fees, any management fees, any real estate. You want this court to do it. You don't want to remand it. Is that right?
That's exactly. May I explain why?
Pardon me?
May I explain why?
Well, I just want to know.
Yes,
you think
absolutely.
This court can do that without a fact finder?
I think the court can do this based on the undisputed facts in the record. And the reason that I asked the court for this remedy is that this litigation is part of the squeeze-out plan. The whole squeeze-out plan over 10 years is that Lynches never get anything. The Lynches have debts. Mr. Bunbury brags about how he arranged for a line of credit for them at the bank. This is no favor. This is helping them go deeper and deeper under. He talks about how he thought the Lynches would have to borrow to pay the capital call. It's a very subtle kind of predatory lending. They go deeper and deeper. They pledge their interests. He knows. He pushes. He keeps the pressure on. No money comes out. Sooner or later, they fall. Sooner or later, the bank's remarkable patience gives out, and the bank says, we have to foreclose. At which point, Mr. Bunbury goes to the foreclosure sale and buys for a song.
Counsel, as long as you've gotten into that, and I want to ask a question. On the agreement in page 16, which, talking about the agreement, 94 agreement, it's a contribution and buyout. You don't have to look at the page. That's just my memory. Now, the buyout basically was that they were going to contribute roughly $250,000, I think it's $263,000. It was done per interest in the LLC. In other words, Bunbury, Rustano paid 37.5%. Your clients paid 25 or 12.5%, which meant that they would come up with $30,000, roughly $30,000 each. Am I correct?
Are you referring to the capital call itself?
I'm talking about the capital call, which was what Judge Flanagan found to be oppressive, the capital call, because he said that they knew the financial condition of your clients. But I just want to know that I have the facts correct, because the oppression, the judge found that this was oppressive conduct. And I think that relates to the other questions that you're discussing. And the issue here is that if the Lynch's is the financial condition of one of the partners or one of the shareholders, is that an absolute necessity, whether they're financially able or otherwise? I don't know, and even after reading this record, I'm not sure what the financial condition of your clients is or was.
Well, the record shows that Bunbury knew and told the LLC's lawyer that the Lynches had debts and unpaid judgments. And the record is also clear that the capital call was not for any proper business purpose.
Well,
the memo, which is A250, is chilling. It reads, Tom told Dan and Judy yesterday he's not going to be running the barn now or never. Jan and Judy were upset, right? When Dan presented his proposal to run the barn for $60,000 sales last fall, Tom told them they were not going to run the barn. Two, Tom would like to suggest through Bucada, take $100,000 now, pay off the banks and other creditors, maybe $20,000 to $50,000 as a premium if necessary. NCH, this is one of the lawyers, suggested that the approach should be, find out how much additional capital it will take to do the next phase from Dick Boots, then make a capital call on all members and explain the process of commitments or non, what happens in case the Lynches do not commit and follow through by deadline. This has two plans. This pressures the Lynches in two ways. One, if they pay, Bunbury says, and in the brief, they knew they were going to have to borrow the money to do it, so they're deeper in debt. And if they don't pay, they're terrified, they're intimidated by this process to sell out, because it's very clear that they know that the Lynches owe the banks. They know that the Lynches have gotten nothing. And it's all about pushing the Lynches towards the point where the Lynches sell out at a fraction of their value. Now, this is exactly the kind of facts that the Supreme Court of South Carolina addressed in the Kyriakides case that they decided in 2001. Nothing out of the company for the minority. Breakdown of trust, complete acrimony. No hope that the minority will ever get anything. How could this sophisticated and successful pair of realty partners not sell these lots in 10 years? Well, Bunbury as much told the trial court, and it's in the appendix that begins about A201 through A207, that it's remarkable. At the same time the March 16, 1999 meeting that was memorialized took place, no sales that year ever occurred after that. There were two closings, but those were sales that occurred before that. Bunbury admitted in A201 to A207, if there were sales, he couldn't justify the capital call. In the testimony, they didn't really know when phase two was going to happen. The capital, at the time that the meeting was held in March 16th, nothing was owed to the managing members. There were no debts due. And it was very clear that they could have gone to the banks, they could have gone to a bank and pledged, if they needed the capital, the interests of the limited liability company. So the capital call had no business purpose, and that's the fact that the trial court found.
Now, counsel, looking at Wisconsin law under the Regett case, if the minority shareholders are treated no more or less favorably than other shareholders, the acts of the majority cannot constitute oppression. So what you're saying, this goes beyond that. This has to do with these facts that you're setting forth, which constitute oppression. In other words, the call wasn't needed. That this money that was going to be used to pay back RBA or for the taxes was not necessary or for any other purpose. That's what you're saying, basically.
I'm saying that's what the trial court found, and I agree with the trial court's finding on that point. And they were added to by the trial court's finding on the appraisal, which essentially was never used for, and the trial court found it was not for any business purpose. It was used to help negotiate against the Lynches. It was a lowball appraisal.
Mr. Ahrens?
Yes, ma'am.
We don't generally take cases to determine whether the findings of fact by the trial court are clearly erroneous, because that's a very tough standard for anyone to overcome. So my interest in the law here is twofold. One you've touched, namely, does the statute that says may dissolve allow more than dissolution? The second legal question that comes to my mind, doesn't mean it's the right question, but that I see, is what does oppression mean or oppressive mean in the statute? So although your time has run out, if you could give us your brief definition of what that means, because that would be a legal issue of what does it mean.
If I may, I will plagiarize from the Oregon Supreme Court.
Fine.
An abuse of corporate position for private gain at the expense of the stockholders is oppressive conduct.
Abuse?
Or the plundering, this is on, this is at 507 Pacific 2nd at 387 at 394. An abuse of corporate position for private gain at the expense of the stockholders is oppressive conduct, or the plundering of a close corporation by the siphoning off of profits by excessive salaries or bonus payments, and the operation, and this, I think, is the essence of this case, and the operation of the business for the sole benefit of the majority stockholders to the detriment of the minority stockholders would constitute such oppressive conduct as to authorize a dissolution. I think that this court must order a dissolution, even if it finds that that's it's one, it's all or nothing. May I direct the court to a remark in Kyriakides?
You can when you're 5 minutes of rebuttal. Thank you. Keep that in mind, counsel. We're now going to hear from Attorney Brian Butler of Stafford Rosenbaum, representing Bunbury and Ristaino.
May it please the Court, my name is Brian Butler, with my co-counsel Michelle Affetati. We're both of the Madison Law Firm of Stafford Rosenbaum. We represent Mr. Bunbury and Mr. Ristaino. I am going to focus on the last issue raised by Justice Abrahamson, the meaning of oppression. It's certainly not a precise term. It gives courts great latitude in deciding whether or not to intervene in the affairs of a business. And on the other side of the coin, it doesn't tell business people much about how they should conduct themselves. It really doesn't say much more than be good. I have three propositions to suggest that I believe would give helpful guidance to trial courts and business people in determining the meaning of oppression. And I'm going to state them and then elaborate on each. The first is this. If the manager's conduct is consistent with the contract and the business judgment rule, the conduct is not oppressive. Second, if the conduct meets the first test, that is, it's consistent with the contract and authorized by the business judgment rule, then a mixed motivation on the manager's part for engaging in the conduct cannot make it oppressive. And third, if the conduct is authorized by the contract, the relative wealth of the parties cannot make it oppressive. Why do these propositions make good sense? Suppose I have a contract with my law partners. In fact, I do have a contract with my law partners, and it's supposed that it authorizes the management of the firm to take action that may be to my detriment. Thousands of cases decided over hundreds of years tell us that they can do it. I promised them that they could do it. I gave them the legal right to do it by entering the contract with them. Apropos here is the legislature's statement of the policy of Chapter 183, quote, to give maximum effect to the principle of freedom of contract and to the enforceability of operating agreements, end quote. Now, in my law firm example, I might assert that law firms, the action of the law firm management, its exercise of discretion is arbitrary. That assertion would bring the business judgment rule into play. And the application of the business judgment rule brings us to this conclusion. If the contract says that the manager has discretion to engage in the conduct, and if an objective observer would conclude that the manager exercised her discretion, honestly believing in good faith that her decision was in the best interests of the corporation, the conduct was not oppressive. I said objective observer evaluating the conduct of the manager because it makes sense to me that the test should be objective rather than subjective. Courts shouldn't be trying to put themselves in the heads of managers and trying to figure out what were they really thinking. They should stand back, look at the conduct, and ask whether the manager undertaking this conduct could reasonably believe that it best served the interests of the corporation.
Do you have to bring in an expert witness to testify to that at a trial?
Would one have to? I don't think so. No.
Mr. Butler, don't we have to give deference to the determination made by the trial court here that this was oppressive conduct?
Well, where I'm leading, Your Honor, is that if you accept these three propositions as making sense, you will overturn the trial court's finding of oppression.
You feel that there was an error of law? Is that basically what you're arguing?
Yes. It was an error of law.
Well, what definition did the trial court use?
Beg your pardon?
What definition of oppressive oppression did the trial court use?
The trial court, I believe, applied the oppression definition that was stated in Jorgensen and Regent.
Okay. Thank you.
The second proposition, which is that if the conduct meets the first test, that is, if it's consistent with the contract and the business judgment rule, mixed motivation on the manager's part for engaging in the conduct cannot make it oppressive. That proposition makes sense because human beings, even judges, are not very good at sorting out mixed motives. People's motivations are usually mixed, and business managers, being human beings, are no different. Their decisions are often tinged with self-interest. There's a natural tendency to think that what's good for me is good for the organization. And if the decision maker actually feels that way, how does a judge sort out accurately and assign primacy to one part of the motive as compared to another part of the motive? And the problem's complicated because in many organizations, I would venture all organizations. There are always dissidents. There are always those who feel abused, that management is going down the wrong track, that management's making the wrong, that management's out to get them. And they will be quick to question most anything management does and suggest that it's in management's self-interest and against theirs. That makes the determination,
Butler,
the motive, all the more difficult.
If you prevail, how do you see this playing out?
In this case,
yeah.
A reversal.
I mean, how do you see this playing out for the Lynches?
For
the Lynches.
Well, the Lynches, Mr. Ahrens talked about Mr. Bunbury taking their ownership interest away from them. He can't do that. I mean, they own 25% of the company. And they're going to continue to own 25% of the company unless there's a capital call and they decide not to draw on their line of credit of several hundreds of thousands of dollars at the State Bank of Cross Plains. It's a line of credit secured by their equity ownership in this successful venture. If they decide not to contribute, then, and Bunbury and Restino do, and their capital counts are accordingly increased, and to some extent, we don't know to what extent because it was never put in evidence, the Lynch's percentage ownership is decreased, then that will be an outcome. But they'll still own whatever it is they own, and it may be that if their share is decreased from 25% to 23% or whatever, as I say, we don't know because it wasn't put in evidence, that 23% is more valuable than the 25% they owned before because Bunbury and Restaino, by putting money in, have enhanced the value of the total enterprise. So if they got an investment.
If you were a shrewd investor and the Lynches came to you and said, we're authorized to sell our share of this LLC, are you interested in buying it?
Well, it would depend on whether I needed dividends on a consistent basis, I needed a cash income, or whether I was investing for appreciation. I was looking for an investment that I expected to grow in value, and I didn't need the cash. But, I mean, if you're asking me personally, sure, I'd be pleased to do a minority owner with Mr. Bunbury. In any event, I think the answer to your question is they remain owners, period. And if their ownership were diminished to some extent, which it wasn't, of course, the capital call never went through, then the harm to them would have to be measured not by that, but by the difference between that diminution in value and the diminution that they would experience if the corporation borrowed money from a bank. Because if there's a borrowing, there are interest payments, which decrease the wealth of the corporation, which decrease the value of their 25% share. That was never put in evidence either. Just like the Lynch's wealth was never put in evidence. That was assiduously avoided by the defense.
I'm embarrassed that I don't know the answer to this, but what is the source of the LLC law in Wisconsin?
The source of the which, Your Honor? I'm sorry.
The limited liability corporation law in Wisconsin. Where did that come from?
Well, I believe it was part of a revision of the corporation laws. It was suggested by a group of experienced academics and practitioners.
Is it a uniform law?
I don't know that.
Well, what's the MBA? You've referred to the MBA, page 18.
Well, there is a Model Business Corporations Act that parallels Chapter 180. But I don't know whether the limited liability, the LLC statute, was part of that or not.
Well, your test on oppression.
Yes.
Where do you get that?
I thought hard about it. It's certainly consistent with the Jorgensen test. It seems to me that you don't have the visual departure from fair standards and so forth that Jorgensen talks about if the conduct complained of is consistent with the contract and with the business judgment rule. And I would make that, I suggest that as the beginning of the inquiry as to whether oppression exists or not.
Is that three-part test the law in any other state?
Not that I know of. Certainly the business judgment test is part of the law of the state. Certainly holding people to their contracts is part of the law of the state. I'm just trying to synthesize these in a way that I think would be helpful to the court in making its decision and would be helpful to business people and lower courts, and for that matter, if I may draw on a theme that Mr. Ahrens mentioned, to the state of Wisconsin. It's nice for business people coming here to know that rules about oppression, for example, are relatively clear. So my suggestion is forget about mixed motive. The better way is to ask, did the contract authorize the conduct? Does it pass muster under the business judgment rule test? And then stop the inquiry. Then you've provided the helpful guidance I've suggested. Now, the third proposition that I advanced was that if the conduct is authorized by the contract and the business judgment rule, the relative wealth of the parties cannot make the conduct oppressive, and that seems to me self-evident. You know, how much richer does somebody have to be to make it oppressive? 100,000, a million? Does the minority shareholder have to be poor? What's poor? Do we adopt the government's definition of poverty? There's just no basis for principled judicial decision-making if relative wealth is part of the test for oppression. Now, if the court agrees with these three propositions, that they make sense, then the court must reverse the trial court's conclusion that Mr. Bunbury oppressed the Lynches. First of all, he had authority under the contract to make the capital call. The contract says, quote, the managing members may determine from time to time that additional contributions are needed to enable the company to conduct its business, end quote. Second, his conduct was permissible under the business judgment rule. Now, the trial court found to the contrary by saying that the LLC had no current need for the funds that were asked for in the capital call. But it's undisputed. I mean, that finding flies in the face of the business judgment rule. It's undisputed that the corporation had bills to pay over the next 6 months. One of them was due within 2 months, insurance bills, real estate tax bills, and so on and so forth. And the LLC had to get that money somewhere. It had to either borrow from a lending institution or it had to ask the members to chip in. It was clear it wasn't going to get the money from Restino Bunbury and Associates, Inc., the real estate company that had been advancing money to the LLC, because that company said, we aren't going to do that anymore. So, was the LLC legally required to borrow money to meet these needs, these obligations? That would be a ridiculous rule of law. The owners, the managers had a right to say, everyone chips in. That decision falls well within the parameters of the business judgment rule. My second proposition is that if that's true, conduct's authorized by the contract and the business judgment rule, then mixed motivation on the part of the manager doesn't make the conduct oppressive. If the court agrees with that, then the trial court's finding that the capital call was intended to assist Mr. Bunbury to negotiate the acquisition of the Lynch's ownership becomes irrelevant.
The mixed motivations issue has nothing to do with the evaluation of whether the decision made was consistent with the business judgment
rule. I'm sorry, Your Honor, I can't hear you.
I'm sorry. The mixed motivations issue, does that have anything at all to do? I know you're arguing that it shouldn't, as a matter of law, have anything to do with an evaluation of the business judgment rule. But as a practical matter, doesn't the evaluation of whether a decision is reasonable within the business judgment rule involve an evaluation of its motivation?
No, I don't think it does. I mean, not in the sense of going inside the decision-maker's head. If it did, there would be nothing wrong with Mr. Bunbury, with what Mr. Bunbury did here. There would be nothing wrong with his having a motivation to get the Lynches to the table. Consider the history of the relationship here. Although the Lynches never agreed in writing to run the stable, it was the understanding that they were going to do that. That was going to be their contribution to the enterprise. And when the stable was almost finished and ready to go, they present Mr. Bunbury with this business plan. Read the business plan. It's a threat. It's an implicit threat. It says, we are essential, we the Lynches, to the success of this venture, and we want this such and such a salary. And Dan Lynch took the gamble of saying, you know, this is the way it's going to be. Bunbury, it's my way or the highway, was his expression. And so these friends from sixth grade, the rift developed. And we had what could potentially be a dysfunctional organization. And under those circumstances, a business divorce makes sense. And both parties realized that. The Lynches hired counsel. They hired Madison Valuation Associates to evaluate their interest. Bunbury had counsel. Lynch's counsel said to Bunbury, make me an offer. He made two offers. No response to either offer. By the time November 1999 rolled around, the Lynches had not demanded anything for their share. What is irresponsible or contrary to the interests of the corporation about Bunbury saying at that point to the Lynches, look, you didn't do what everyone understood you would do to make this thing work. As a consequence, the development is in trouble. We've made two lot sales in 1999 because the word is out that you're no longer part of this venture. You're the horse people with the expertise to make this go, and you've walked away. If you want to stay in it, then do what Ron and I are doing. Put up some cash to pay the bills that the corporation has to pay. And if you're not interested, maybe you should consider coming to the table and selling out so that this unhappy marriage can dissolve. Why is that inconsistent with the best interests of the company? I suggest it's not.
Well, let me ask you what your remedy is. You cross-appealed on the finding that your client's conduct was oppressive or amounted to oppression, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm looking at page 77 of your brief, and then you say, suppose you lose on that issue, and the court says, okay, we're going to affirm that finding. Then you're saying that the remedy is dissolution, if I read your piece right. But then you say the relief that the trial court did grant the Lynches was improper, because dissolution is the only statutory remedy. However, your clients don't challenge that relief on appeal. What relief don't you challenge, dissolution or the relief granted by the trial court?
The relief granted by the trial court.
So you don't want a finding of oppression, therefore the finding that there'd be any remedy would fall, right? Business would go on as usual if you won flat out, right?
Yes, business would go on as usual, except that the Lynches would have the right to sell their interest, as the trial court ordered. And
well, what does the contract say about selling interest?
The contract says that they can't sell without the Bunburys' consent,
right,
which they've never asked for.
Right, but the trial court said they can sell without your consent, didn't they?
That's correct.
Okay. So if you should lose on oppression, what's your position on the remedy?
Well, our position is that there should be no remedy. But I feel a little odd saying that because we did not challenge the remedy on appeal. It seems to me the court could make the ruling because the Lynches raise the whole question of what's an appropriate remedy.
Right.
Now, I'd like to just emphasize that that doesn't leave people in the position of the Lynches without a remedy. They made a deliberate choice here, unlike the plaintiffs in Jorgensen and Regent, who pleaded breach of fiduciary duty, which caused injury to those plaintiffs as opposed to injury to the corporation. They pled derivative claims. The Lynches, advised by sophisticated counsel, chose not to do that. They chose one path, and that's the path of the statute that provides only dissolution as remedy.
That's why I asked the question that I did earlier about whether a claim at common law existed for this sort of claim if it did not exist at statute, and whether or not such a claim had been asserted here. I didn't have time to go back and look at the complaint. There was just the statutory claim asserted?
No such claim was asserted. No such claim was proved. No such claim was pursued.
So the plaintiffs proceeded purely on the basis of the statutory claim, statutory remedy.
That was their choice.
All right. And if so, the statutory interpretation question about remedy here is a straight-up statutory interpretation question. That is, what remedy is provided by the statute, and not the sort of preemption question that was at issue in the Jorgensen case.
That's correct, Your Honor. It's a straight question of statutory interpretation, and it seems to me the most telling evidence of the legislature's intent is that in the closed corporation statute, it provided a panoply of remedies that it didn't provide in the statute. In the straight Chapter 180 corporation statute, the legislature refused to adopt a Model Business Corporation Act provision that permits majority owners to buy out if the judge says, look, either there's a buyout or I'm going to dissolve. They left that out. So what we can infer from this, what the court can infer with certainty, is that when the legislature intends to provide a remedy for oppression other than dissolution, it knows how to do that. It has done that.
And the remedy of dissolution in this statute is permissive, not mandatory.
That's correct.
It's a discretionary judgment on the part of the trial court if the appropriate predicate findings are made. So it is an all or nothing. I mean, you've got the one remedy of dissolution, that if the judge makes the findings, he or she then moves to the question of whether or not to dissolve the corporation.
Yes, there's certainly no authorization in the statute to buy out. I mean, really, what the Lynches are asking for is that the court rewrite the contract for them. I mean, none of the parties to that contract negotiated for and received a buyout provision. They should have, but they didn't.
And at common law, had there been a common law claim asserted here for breach of fiduciary duty or whatever category of common law claim it would fall under, what would the available remedies be? Would they include the sort of creative remedy that the trial court fashioned here?
Well, I really don't know the answer to that. I don't think Regent or Jorgensen addressed or decided that. I don't think the court has to decide that in this case. It just, you know, ordering a buyout is such an extraordinary remedy, as the Chief Justice pointed out. What do you do? She asked Mr. Aarons, you get appraisers? Well, he didn't like that idea too well. Do you discount for the minority interest? How do you make that work in a way that's fair?
Counsel?
But I don't know whether a court in the exercise of its general equity power could do it or not, or would find it wise to do or not.
Counsel, so your approach is dissolution and only dissolution, but it seems to me, or nothing at all. But your prior comments targeted on what's in the best interest of the company.
Yes.
And I don't think the legislature would enact intentionally something that might be contrary to the best interest of the company. Dissolution is a drastic remedy. The disruption caused by dissolution, you know, not only in this kind of a fact situation, but maybe in a much larger fact situation implicating the lives of many, many more people,
Yes.
And I find it difficult to reconcile the kind of disruption that comes with dissolution of a large enterprise and the legislature saying that's the only remedy available because it would be so contrary to the interest of the corporation.
Well, it kills the corporation.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you think that's the only – is that what the legislature intended? Is the only remedy killing the corporation?
I think what it suggests is the situation has got to be really, really bad. But if it is really, really bad, you know, if there are deadlocks, if the corporation is not operating effectively, then sure, it does make sense.
And the lives of all the people, the workers for that LLC, the people that are employed by it, then that's just it. Go home. You know, pack your bags and go home. That's what the legislature
probably
intended.
Not, because probably on the auction block, someone's going to buy the company and is going to need all employees and hire them back. And that's the way it would probably work. My time's up. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Butler. Mr. Ahrens, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
I would first like to direct the Court to Kirikides, the Atlas Food Systems and Services. This is at 541 Southeast 2nd, 257. And there the Court said that a buyout was necessary because without a buyout, it was unlikely that the minority would ever receive any benefit from their ownership interests. And it noted one of the remarks is extremely helpful here. It said, the primary vulnerability of a minority shareholder is the specter of being locked in. That is, having a perpetual investment in an entity without any expectation of ever receiving a return on that investment. Now, the respondent cited to Mr. Hensel, who said he, in his business, would plan to sell lots in 2 years, and he'd project a profit and when he would expect to get that. It's been 10 years, and there are no profits, no projections of profits, and no plans. So what we're talking about here is we're not talking about nobody who dissents when people are making money. Nobody dissents when the profits are coming in. What happens is when there are apparently no profits, or at least no profits to be distributed. And that's what the circumstance here. Mr. Butler talks about the business judgment rule. He says an objective observer. Well, there's no record in the nothing at trial where the respondents placed in any expert who suggested that anything they did met an objective standard. This is one of the arguments that we made that there was all the self-dealing, but no earmarks of arm's-length dealing.
Well, there are lots of objective tests in the law that do not require expert testimony to prove them up, aren't there?
Well, I would agree, but whether or not at a particular point, given a particular financial situation of a company, it should go to a bank or issue a capital call, that would be a subject for expert testimony.
Do you agree that it's an objective test then?
Oh, of course. But the point here is that the defendants put in no evidence except their own extremely conclusory arguments.
So subjective motivations do not play a part. You also agree with that?
I'm not sure. I think, are you directing to the second prong, the mixed motive?
Well, right. I'd like to ask you a global question about what you think of Mr. Butler's three-part extrapolation of the test for oppressiveness.
I think it's imaginative, but totally wrong and totally unsupported by any court ever.
I think you would probably say that.
Okay. But let me address the mixed motive point. The mixed motive point is remarkable because what the respondents is advocating here is they are advocating that this court go back almost 100 years to where minority shareholders, it's buyer beware and devil take the hindmost. And unless you can prove you can catch somebody literally stealing money out of the till, embezzling money, you really have no hope. Now, let me suggest to you why that is absolutely the wrong way to go. And why the courts have increasingly upheld stronger and stronger protections for minorities. What happens here is we have small companies, closely held companies. These are the engines of economic growth. This is where everything is born. This is where it begins. The people who have those ideas
They want to hang on to their companies, but they must have capital. And that capital is going to come from California, New York, other places. And the choice is going to be, do we invest in Michigan? Do we invest in Illinois? Do we invest in Wisconsin? What happens? We don't know who we're getting in bed with. What happens if it turns out that there's mismanagement or there's difficulties, or how are we protected? The simple thing is that, and I think every other court recognizes this, is that if they want capital to be available to their citizens, if Wisconsin entrepreneurs are going to get that capital to come in as minority investments, there has to be protections.
There's also a strong policy in the law, though, to hold people to their contracts. And if the contract permits what was done, and there's nothing wrong with it under the business judgment rule as an objective matter, then why isn't what Mr. Butler is suggesting appropriate policy?
Well, but that's exactly what oppression is, the definitions of oppression have addressed. What they've said is it doesn't have to be strictly fraudulent. It doesn't have to be strictly illegal. What we're talking about here is walking the interstices of the relationship to find vulnerabilities and exploit them. I thought that Mr. Butler's remark about mixed motives was remarkable, because what he did is he actually conceded that Mr. Bunbury was preying on the lynches, which is in fact what he's been doing. He's conceding that he can manipulate the way the business works so then he can put a position to the lynches, knowing that they are going to be encouraged to sell out at a low price. He should put his energy into making profits for everyone. That's what the rule against oppression says. You make profits for everyone. That's what Baker says. That's what Kirikide says. Instead of trying to figure out how to squeeze people out, go out and earn money and do things well. The business judgment rule says, we won't interfere with you if you pick this architect or that architect. That's the business judgment rule. But there was no evidence objectively here. I see my time's up, but I have one correction of the record, if I may.
Do it quickly, please.
Mr. Butler talked about the $700,000 line of credit. There's no such evidence. Moreover, the line of credit has to be approved. Disbursements have to be approved by Mr. Bunbury. So with that, I see my time's up.
Thank you, Counsel.
Do you know whether our law is based on a uniform law?
I do not know, but I believe that it is.
Well, one problem I have, if this is based on a uniform law, I don't think this court would be very smart to be just creating interpretations of a uniform law that are inconsistent with other states. The problem I have with your argument is that you've cited cases from South Carolina and Oregon, and those statutes are not listed. Those states don't have statutes that are listed as comparable statutes. So I'm a little troubled by both arguments here.
Can I respond?
Yes, go ahead.
The LLC statute is new, and there simply is no jurisprudence about it.
1993 here.
Right, but there is no jurisprudence in the way that there's jurisprudence with regard to corporate oppression and closely held corporate oppressions. I think most of the case talk about closely held companies, and I think of force, we have to use that wisdom in looking at the statute.
No, that's my response. We have Jorgensen and we have Regett, right? Those are the Court of Appeals cases that we have, which you said that because they are Court of Appeals cases, we should not really consider them that strongly.
Well, I think that they apply perfectly well here to give the relief to my clients. Jorgensen certainly took a broad view, cited many of the cases, Fix versus Fix and others. It took a broad view of the subject. I thought it addressed it in great breadth. It certainly came up with a definition of oppression that was contrary to Mr. Butler's.
So, Mr. Butler, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Your Honors, it's true. There is no direct evidence that the Lynches have a $700,000 line of credit. But as I told you, the Lynches never did take the stand or present documents as to what their net worth was. The thrust of the evidence about their relative poverty was admissions from Mr. Bunbury that he thought they didn't have much money. They never testified about it. But what they're now saying is that their interest in the LLC is worth two-thirds of $1 million based on Bunbury's sworn financial statement. Second, the suggestion has been made that there's no evidence that the Lynches will make money out of this venture. And in his opening comments, Mr. Ahrens referred to the testimony of the veterinarian, Dr. Meyer. Let's see what Dr. Meyer said. Dr. Meyer, I don't think you were here earlier today, but Dr. Schultz from your office testified about a conversation she had with Tom Bunbury about a year and a half to 2 years ago. She testified that she then told you about this conversation and that the conversation had something to do with the conversation she had with Tom Bunbury and the money and the Lynches. Did Dr. Schultz tell you about the conversation she had with Tom Bunbury? Yes, she did. What did Dr. Schultz tell you? She told me that Mr. Bunbury had said that Mr. Lynch would not receive a cent from Carriage Ridge. Dr. Schultz, who told it to Dr. Meyer, also testified. Her testimony is, I remember briefly Tom saying not to expect our clinic to get the money in that way, that the Lynches were not going to be receiving a huge amount of money from him. So the testimony of the veterinarian certainly falls short of what Mr. Ahrens purported it to be. You know, the fact is, as the evidence showed, this is a development that is going to go in three phases. Only the first phase is finished. The other two phases cannot proceed until some adjacent land has been developed and the county's requirement about the length of roads can be satisfied. But there is no reason to think that the Lynches will not make profit once those two phases proceed, and there is certainly no evidence in the record that proves that they won't. I did not say that mixed motive should not be considered. The statement was that if the manager's conduct is authorized by the contract, and if it's consistent with the business judgment rule, that is, if in the eyes of an objective observer the conduct is honestly and in good faith undertaken for the best interests of the corporation, then mixed motive should not be considered because it really serves no useful purpose. Your Honors, lawyers are never supposed to stop before their time is up, but I have nothing more to say unless there are questions from the court.
It won't be held against you, just but tell me what, if you were able to write this opinion, how would you write it?
I would state the definition of oppression, incorporating the three propositions that I've suggested, and I would say, as a matter of law, there was no oppression here on the facts found by the trial court. I would say either that the remedy granted by the trial court will stand because Bunbury and Restaino didn't challenge it, or that because it was made an issue by the Lynches, that remedy is dissolved, reversed, and the case is remanded with orders to dismiss.
Chief, if I may. Never mind.
You see, your time is up, so that's fine.
Thank you, Mr. Butler, and thank you, Mr. Ahrens, for interesting arguments on a statute which this Court has had limited opportunity to interpret. That concludes the hearing in 02-0528, Lynch versus Carriage Ridge. The Court will take a brief recess so that students may leave and other students may enter, if that's what's going to be happening.